Good afternoon. This is Bob Kruger with Thought for Food for June 2012. This program is heard on the third Wednesday of the month at 4 p.m. and repeated on the third Saturday of the month at 3 p.m. It's intended for a print and blind impaired audience, but hopefully will be of interest to everyone. Are you aware that General Mills has now 9 varieties of Cheerios? The original Cheerios were made solely of oat bran and were touted as being healthful. It seems to me that the 8 ensuing varieties have added fruits, yogurt, and I suspect added sweeteners. So the next time you're in the cereal aisle, look closely at the labels. The North Carolina State Legislature began its short session in mid-May, and one of the issues to be discussed is whether to allow drilling for natural gas using a technology called hydraulic fracturing, or fracking for short. The Department of Environment and Natural Resources has issued a report concluding that hydraulic fracking is safe to conduct, assuming a hefty list of precautions is put in place. But that's the rub. Will our water be vigorously protected? When it comes to our diet, what is more basic and important than clean water? It's the one ingredient every one of us consumes and couldn't live without, and that's why we should take threats to the water supply seriously. The Department of Environment and Natural Resources report gave a long list of recommended actions that should take place before fracking is allowed here in North Carolina. They include a collection of baseline data about current contamination of groundwater, development of a drilling waste management regulatory program, identification of areas such as floodplains where drilling should not be permitted, requirements for disclosure of the chemicals to be used, and a determination of the liability for environmental contamination, particularly for groundwater. This report also includes important points that easily get lost when the debate heats up. There's little information about the makeup of the underground geological formations in which the natural gas is located. There's also less separation between the gas-infused layer and potential drinking water supplies compared to the underground structures in other fracking operations in this country. There's little data on how fracking affects groundwater supplies. The Environmental Protection Agency is working on a study with a final report due in 2014. Our State Department of Environmental and Natural Resources study states, to our knowledge, no comprehensive studies are currently available on long-term impacts on health from hydraulic fracturing for natural gas. That statement is a big flashing warning signal. Will we heed it? Remember, some of us cook with gas and we all cook with water. If at some time in the future you may want to consider bottled water, here's some information about the sources of water that are available on the market today. Artesian water is obtained from a well that taps a confined aquifer, an underground layer of rock or sand that contains water. An example of artesian water is Fiji natural artesian water. Distilled water is water that's been boiled and the steam condensed back into water. Distilling kills microbes and removes minerals, giving water a flat taste. An example of distilled water on today's market is Glassau Smart Water. Groundwater that naturally contains at least 250 parts per million of dissolved solids can be labeled mineral water. All minerals and other trace elements must be present in the water when it emerges at its source. In other words, nothing can be added. A great deal of bottled water comes from public water sources, also known as municipal water supply. Purified water can come from any source that's been treated to remove chemicals and pathogens according to the standards set by the U.S. Pharmacopoeia. It must contain no more than 10 parts of dissolved solids. Purification methods including distillation, deionization, and reverse osmosis. Aquafina and Dasani, probably the two most advertised bottled waters, are of this class. Spring water is derived from an underground formation from which water flows naturally to the Earth's surface. Spring water must be collected at the spring or through a borehole tapping the underground source feeding the spring. Other terms you may see are glacier water or mountain water, but they have no standards of definition. Those terms sound to me like advertising suggestions. Those of us who receive our municipal water from the Raleigh water system are fortunate that it tests very well. So I ask, If we have such a good source of water, why would we want to pay much more for bottled water? How do you like your baked potato? Too often we think a big bunch of calories. But that's not the potato, but what we dress it with that greatly increases the calorie count. Ronnie Fine, who writes for the Connecticut Post, shares these comments about the potato. Baked potatoes are one of the most wondrous foods that can bring glory to home cooks everywhere. Roast one plain in a hot oven, the skin becomes crusty, the steamy inside tender with a rich mineral tang that hints of earth. The dish needs nothing else except perhaps a sprinkle of sea salt and freshly ground black pepper. It's the perfect accompaniment to grilled fish or steak, a roast chicken or lamb chops. On the other hand, a baked potato, very simplicity makes it a perfect candidate for creative treatments. Stuffed potatoes, some call them twice baked, are among the most delicious treasures to explore. They're versatile too, making them useful as a snack or for lunch, as a part of a meatless dinner or a side dish with meat, poultry, or fish. Simple stuffed potato preparations can be easy and quick. Mix the cooked potato flesh with some cottage cheese or cooked vegetables, grated cheese, crumbled bacon, leftover meat or chicken, chopped ham, or even esoteric items, such as duck rouletties or fresh oysters. But you can elaborate, too. If you had enough ingredients, a baked stuffed potato becomes the entree, either meaty or vegetarian. It all begins with a ripe potato, and that means a russet or Idaho potato, which is oval with dark brown, thick, rough-looking skin. A russet's flesh is the driest, so it bakes the fluffiest, and no other variety beats its skin for sheer crunch. It's a cinch to bake potatoes properly. Scrub them first and be sure to reheat the oven to 400 degrees so they get a blast of searing crust-forming heat immediately. It's not necessary to rub them with oil, and don't wrap them in aluminum foil, which steams the potato rather than baking them and causes the skin to be soggy. Before you put the potatoes in the oven, pierce the skin in one place with a knife. Otherwise, the steam building inside could cause them to burst in your oven. Potatoes are done when you can easily pierce them through the skin to the middle with a knife. Let them rest for a few minutes so that you can handle them easily. Then cut them in half lengthways, which is easier and faster to do with a serrated knife. Scoop out the flesh into a bowl and mix in the other ingredients and spoon the mixture back into the hollowed skins. We can reheat the potato halves immediately in the oven or for a crisper surface under the broiler. But one of the bonuses of stuffed potatoes is the reheat factor. Save them for another hour or day in the refrigerator and pull them out about a half hour before you bake them the second time and put them on a cookie sheet to reheat in a moderate height oven, hot oven, about 375 degrees. Some versions are freezable, most with cheese or spinach, for example. Wrap the halves individually in plastic wrap. Serving size depends on how you plan to use the potatoes. As an accompaniment to a meat entree, one half of a stuffed potato is enough. As a main course, as a part of a vegetarian dinner, you may need extra. I think this story will inspire me to prepare some twice-baked potatoes, but I'll have to watch the amount of butter, sour cream, and those other goodies. I may be tempted to add ingredients that raises the calorie count. Wish me luck. Melissa Clark, who writes for the New York Times, tells of her experiences with asparagus. Since we've been talking about healthful side dishes, her comments are timely. She was introduced to asparagus as a child by her parents, who served it with hollandaise sauce. She continues, "I don't know if the asparagus we were able to get changed or our taste changed, but at some time in my childhood, my parents stopped peeling and ditched the special steamer and the hollandaise sauce. Asparagus was downgraded to an everyday side dish. Instead of steaming, we roasted, sautéed, grilled, or poached. In these days, when I want the grassy, clean flavor of steamed asparagus, I cook it in my regular steamer basket. This method works best using thinner asparagus with uniform, slender stalks. Watch them carefully and take them out of the basket while they're still crisp, since the carryover heat will finish softening them. You want them just tender, but not at all limp. The tips shouldn't flop over when you hold a spear by the end. All you taste is fresh green asparagus, at least until you dunk the spears into some kind of sauce. I personally feel that asparagus is an acquired taste, but when you learn to enjoy it, you really like it. We cook it a number of ways, including steaming and roasting. Steamed with a little butter is my favorite way to enjoy asparagus. And while we're speaking of side dishes, would we ever have thought of Brussels sprouts? Brussels sprouts' transformation from maligned cafeteria gross-out fare to foodie luminary is complete. Trendy New York restaurants gussy them up with pig fat and sell them by a tiny $8 a plateful. David Chang's Brussels sprouts at New York's Monofuku restaurant were so popular he had to take them off the menu for the cook's well-being. Popular food bloggers Ree Drummond, absolutely to die for, Deb Perlman, I love those tiny cabbage heads, and Heidi Swanson, it's not unusual for us to cook them two or three times a week, have sworn their allegiance. I love Brussels sprouts, shouts from T-shirts, bumper stickers, and baseball caps. We get it. Brussels sprouts are delicious. Named for the capital of Belgium, although originally from ancient Rome, they're pleasantly dense and milder than their cruciferous relatives, broccoli, cauliflower, and cabbage. It's hard to ruin them unless you boil them to death or undercook them. Frankly, it's their erstwhile bad reputation, not their newfound popularity, that's baffling. Scientists have suggested that some people's distaste for the vegetable is due to genetics rather than culinary methods. Making Brussels sprouts delicious requires the usual suspects for making things delicious: fat, salt, and good timing. Fat is necessary for its flavor, then for its browning and crisping properties. Without it, your Brussels sprouts will never be golden, crunchy, and gently caramelized. Salt is obviously a universal flavor enhancer, but it's necessary to balance out Brussels sprouts' inherent sweetness. And timing is more important for sprouts than for many other vegetables. You need to get them fully tender, but not mushy, and neatly brown, but not charcoal-like. Some folks trim them and then cut the sprouts in half using a sauce of some sort and then baking them in a preheated oven. I may have to try my hand with some Brussels sprouts, as in my past experience with them was negative with a capital N. If you're a burger fan in North Carolina, you just got a big step closer to being able to say, make it rare. The North Carolina Commission for Public Health has approved the adoption of most of the 2009 Federal Food Code. Among other changes, it will allow restaurant customers to order raw or undercooked foods if the restaurant provides a warning, usually a note on the menu to remind you it's dangerous. A similar procedure is already followed in many states. Larry Michael, the head of the Food Protection Branch of the North Carolina Division of Environmental Health, warns that the new rules haven't passed yet. They have to clear a review commission on June 21st, and the new rules won't be in effect until at least September 1st. But the change has cleared the biggest hurdle, he said. This really does represent the largest comprehensive change in our food safety rules in over 30 years. How big is that? It's so big that when they called chef owner Tom Condren at the Liberty in Charlotte, a pub known for its burgers, he was actually willing to come to the phone during the noon hour rush. It's about time, he said happily. The quality of the beef and the preparation have come so far. It's about time North Carolina stepped up. For restaurants like us and others that grind in-house and take all the steps to make sure we get top quality beef, it's an important change. Michael said adopting the Federal Food Code allows North Carolina to use the latest research in forming its own food safety standards. The majority of states use it, he said. It's the most comprehensive standard out there. If it passes, it will bring more changes than just your burger order. Among other things, it will ban bare hand contact with prepared foods, meaning restaurant workers will have to wear gloves or use tongs when they handle ready-to-eat foods. But the big one, Michael admitted, is the standard to allow customers to request raw or undercooked foods. As it is now, undercooked burgers are often served to customers, even though the restaurant isn't supposed to do it, a sort of a wink-and-nudge approach to food safety. What the new regulation would do is to put the decision in the hands of the consumer. The restaurant would have to tell you that you're ordering a food that isn't cooked to a safe level and to tell you that eating raw or undercooked food puts you at the risk of a foodborne illness such as salmonella. The federal code still recommends cooking ground beef to an internal temperature of 155 degrees, and that rule prohibits serving undercooked or raw foods to children. Recently, when eating out, I ordered a burger and asked for as rare as possible. I might have been in one of those wink-a-nudge places. I like a burger with the meat juices showing red, and this one filled the bill. It's the most delicious hamburger I've eaten in a very long time. One of life's simple pleasures just got a little sweeter. After years of waffling research on coffee and health, and even some fear that Java might raise the risk of heart disease, a big study finds the opposite. Coffee drinkers are a little more likely to live longer. Regular or decaf doesn't matter. This study of 400,000 people is the largest everyone ever done on this issue, and results should reassure any coffee lovers who think it's a guilty pleasure that may do harm. Our study suggests that's not really the case, said the lead researcher, Neil Friedman, of the National Cancer Institute. There may actually be a modest benefit of coffee drinking. No one knows why. Coffee contains 1,000 things that can affect health, from helpful antioxidants to tiny amounts of substances linked to cancer. Caffeine didn't play a role in the new study's results. It's not that earlier studies were wrong. There's evidence that coffee can raise LDL, or bad cholesterol, and blood pressure, at least short term, and there, in turn, can raise the risk of heart disease. Even in the new study, it seems that coffee drinkers are more likely to die at any given time, but they also tend to smoke, drink more alcohol, eat more red meat, and exercise less than non-coffee drinkers. Once researchers took those things into account, a clear pattern emerged. Each cup of coffee per day nudged up the chance of living longer. This study was done by the National Institutes of Health and the AARP. The results were published in the May 17th issue of the New England Journal of Medicine. This doesn't prove coffee makes people live longer, only that the two seem related. Like most studies on diet and health, this one was based strictly on observing people's habits and resulting health. But with so many people, more than a decade of follow-up and enough deaths to compare, this is probably the best evidence we have and are likely to get, said Dr. Frank Hugh of the Harvard School of Public Health. He had no role in this study, but helped lead a previous one that also found coffee beneficial. This new one began in 1995 and involved AARP members ages 50 to 71 in California, Florida, Louisiana, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Atlanta and Detroit. People who had already had heart disease or a stroke or cancer weren't included. Neither were folks on extreme diets, too many or too few calories per day. The rest gave information on coffee drinking. Since at the heart of the study, people are fairly consistent in their coffee drinking over their lifetime, so the simple measure shouldn't be a limitation, Friedman said. Of the 402,260 participants, about 42,000 drank no coffee. About 15,000 drank 6 cups or more a day. Most people had 2 or 3. By 2008, about 52,000 of them had died. Compared to those who drank no coffee, men who had 2 or 3 cups a day were 10% likely to die at any age. For women, it was 13%. Even a single cup a day seemed to lower the risk a little, 6% in men and 5% in women. I've been a coffee drinker for many years and enjoy it very much. I noticed that no mention was made as to the items we might use to slightly change the flavor of our cups. I refer to sweeteners, various kinds of creamers, and so forth. I usually drink mine black. With the positive spin that this study gives us, I would not recommend anyone to start drinking coffee to improve one's chances to live a little longer. With the new studies taking place almost every day, it's no wonder that we thought that the proper thing to do was, we learn, may not be the best for us. In January, a new study announced that nearly a third of middle-aged Americans regularly take a baby aspirin in hopes of preventing a heart attack or a stroke or lowering your cancer risk. But new research shows that aspirin is not for everyone, and in some patients, this wonder drug is doing more harm than good. I stop a lot more aspirin than I start, said Dr. Allison Bailey, director of the Cardiac Rehabilitation Program at the Gill Heart Institute at the University of Kentucky. People don't even consider aspirin a medicine or consider that you can have side effects from it, and that's the most challenging part of aspirin therapy. Researchers in London reported they had analyzed 9 randomized studies of aspirin use in the United States, Europe, and Japan that included more than 100,000 participants. The study subjects had never had a heart attack or stroke, all regularly took aspirin or a placebo to determine whether aspirin benefits people who have no established heart disease. In the combined analysis, researchers found that regular aspirin users were 10% less likely than others to have any type of heart event and 20% less likely to have a non-fatal heart attack. While that sounds like good news, the study showed that the risk of regular aspirin outweighed the benefits. Aspirin users were about 30% more likely to have a serious gastrointestinal bleeding event, a side effect of frequent aspirin use. The overall risk of dying during the study was the same among aspirin users and others. And though some previous studies suggested that regular aspirin use could prevent cancer, the new analysis showed no such benefit. Overall, for every 162 people who took aspirin, the drug prevented 1 non-fatal heart attack, but caused about 2 serious bleeding episodes. We have been able to show quite convincingly that people without a previous heart attack or stroke, regular use of aspirin may be more harmful than it is beneficial, said Dr. Shashihai of the Cardiovascular Science Research Center at St. George's University of London. The findings are likely to add to the confusion about who should regularly take aspirin and those who should not. Research shows that among men who have a heart attack, regular aspirin use can be life-saving, lowering the risk of a second heart attack by 20 to 30%. It also reduces the recurrence of among women by a blood clot. In 2007, the U.S. Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality reported that 19% of Americans regularly took aspirin, including 27% of those ages 45 to 64, about half of those 65 and older. I take a baby aspirin a day, but I've never had any heart problems. This study made me think of the next time I see my doctor, I may ask him to let me stop taking it. I'll let you know, as I won't see him until November. We've been told that cooking and serving dried beans is not only helpful, but also economical. And here are some suggestions on how to do it, a possibly better way to do so. Try to buy dried beans at a store that has good turnover. The older they are, the more difficulty there is in getting them creamy and tender. If they're too old, they never get them right and end up breaking into shards. How do you determine how long the beans have been in the store? Dried beans do not have to be dated as when they were packed. Stay away from any packaging that looks battered or dusty. There are many ways to minimize beans' digestive side effects. If you don't treat them, they'll maintain too many oligosaccharides, which are indigestible sugars. People used to tell us to cook the beans in the water in which they were soaked. Now they suggest we change the water. The more the rinse, the fewer the oligosaccharides, because they're soluble. Cooking dried beans with sugar intensifies the problem. Smaller beans and legumes, such as lentils, have few oligosaccharides. In addition to over-the-counter solutions such as Beano, there are folk remedies such as cooking with cumin, ginger, cilantro, summer savory, or an herb called epazote, which is often found in Mexican markets. We're told that we can't cook dried beans, we can purchase them canned. They do suggest that those beans should be rinsed to avoid excess salt. I don't, as a practice, do book reviews, but the headline read, "What Will We Eat in 2035? Although I won't be around by 2035, the title intrigued me. The article continued, "What's for dinner?" This is a question that most of us ask every day in hopes of having an answer by nightfall. Journalist Josh Schoenwald wonders what will be on the table in 2035. His research of discovery takes him to the fertile fields of California, to a fish farm in Virginia, to a Dutch laboratory working on test tube meat. Food used to be fun. No one thought too much about where food came from or if anything tasted good could possibly be bad for them. It was one big delicious binge. Today we seem to be an endless morning after. Food is news, the stuff of grim political polemics. Schoenwald examines the issues, the personalities and trends in a fast-moving trip through the multi-billion-dollar food industry. Exploring what we'll be eating in 2035, he weaves a story of taste and technology, environmental demands, and consumer desire. This is said to be a fun book written in a way that the average reader can understand seriously complicated issues. I want to see if I can find this book, which is entitled The Taste of Tomorrow, Dispatches from the Future of Food, in the library. It sounds very interesting. One suggestion for the answer to the question, what's for dinner, might be roast chicken. They're easy to prepare and usually good for more than one meal. My suggestion is to select a large frying chicken rather than a roasting chicken. There's usually a good bit of difference in price. If you don't feel up to it, ready-to-eat roasted chickens are available in many supermarkets. If you purchase one of them, take it straight home and then either use it or refrigerate it. Kathleen Purvis, who's the food editor of the Charlotte Observer, receives a number of letters from readers that are often interesting because they're questions we might ask. And here are some examples. Question. So many recipes call for yellow onions, but yet there are white onions, sweet onions, and red onions. Does it matter if the recipe specifies a yellow onion and you use one of the others? And the answer, it does seem like there's an endless variety of onions, and since they each have taste a little different, we can vary recipes by changing whether we use a scallion or a shallot. But they are still all onions. As long as the onion is the same basic type, such as a bulb onion, the results will be similar. A red onion may be more intense than a white onion, but the recipe will work with either one. However, one advantage of the yellow onion is price. Yellow onions usually are much cheaper than sweet onions or red onions, which is why so many recipes use them as their kitchen workhorses. In another letter, Mrs. Purvis was asked, how do I keep leftover brown sugar from turning into a brick? I have to use a hammer to break off pieces. The answer, here's the trick that always works for me, double bag it. After opening the package, put the open bag in a resealable freezer bag and press it closed. Freezer bags are heavier and more airtight than regular resealable bags. If you do have hardened brown sugar, you don't have to hammer it. If you know you need softened brown sugar in 12 to 24 hours, put a slice of apple in the bag and close the bag. If you need the sugar immediately, put sugar in the microwave oven and heat it on low to a medium power for a minute until it softens. The first Wednesday in July will be the 4th, and on this day we will celebrate the 236th birthday of our country. It's a day when we should be thankful we live in a country that has the gifts, the opportunities, and the obligations that the United States of America offers its citizens. And until next month at this time, this has been Bob Kruger with Thought for Food for 2012, and have an enjoyable summer.